Grime's great-grandfather soon after. If Jack Randall was dead and childless, how would Frank been born? And yet his ring was still upon my hand. He had existed, would exist. I comforted myself with the thought, rubbing the ring in the darkness, as though it contained a ginny that could advise me. I woke out of a sound sleep some time later with a half-scream. "Shh! 'Tis only me," the large hand lifted from my mouth. With the candle out, the room was pitch black. I groped blindly until my hand struck something solid. "You shouldn't be out of bed," I exclaimed, still groggy with sleep. My fingers slid over smooth, cold flesh. "You're freezing."
"Well, of course I am," he said somewhat crossly. "I haven't got any clothes on, and it's perishing in the corridor. Will you let me in bed?"
I wriggled as far over as I could in the narrow cot, and he slid in naked beside me, clutching me for warmth. His breathing was uneven, and I thought his trembling was from weakness as much as from cold.
"God, you're warm."
He snuggled closer, sighing.
"It feels good to hold you, Sassnach."
I didn't bother asking what he was doing there. That was becoming quite plain. Nor did I ask whether he was sure. I had my own doubts, but wouldn't voice them for fear of making self-fulfilling prophecies.
I rolled to face him, mindful of the injured hand. There was that sudden, startling moment of joining, that quick, gliding strangeness that at once becomes familiar. Jamie sighed deeply, with satisfaction and, perhaps, relief. We lay still for a moment, as though afraid to disturb our fragile link by moving. Jamie's good hand caressed me slowly, feeling its way in the dark, fingers spread like a cat's whiskers, sensitive to vibration. He moved against me, once, as though asking a question, and I answered him in the same language. We began a delicate game of slow movements, a balancing act between his desire and his weakness, between pain and the growing pleasure of the body. Somewhere in the dark, I thought to myself that I must tell Anselm that there was another way to make time stop, but then thought, perhaps not, as it wasn't a way open to a priest. I held Jamie steady with a light hand on his scarred back. He set our rhythm, but let me carry the force of our movement. We were both silent, save our breathing, until the end. Feeling him tiring, I grasped him firmly and pulled him to me, rocking my hips to take him deeper, forcing him toward the climax. "Now," I said softly. "Come to me. Now." He put his forehead hard against mine and yielded himself to me with a quivering sigh. The Victorians called it the little death, and with good reason. He lay so limp and heavy that I would have thought him dead if not for the slow thump of his heart against my ribs. It seemed a long time before he stirred and mumbled something against my shoulder.
"What did you say?"
He turned his head so his mouth was just below my ear. I felt warm breath on my neck.
"I said," he answered softly, "my hand doesn't hurt at all just now."
The good hand gently explored my face, smoothing away the wetness on my cheeks.
"Were you afraid for me?" he asked.
"Yes," I said. "I thought it was too soon." He laughed softly in the dark.
"It was. I almost killed myself." "Aye, I was afraid too. But I woke with my hand paining me and couldn't go back to sleep. I was tossing about, feeling lonely for you. The more I thought about you, the more I wanted you, and I was halfway down the corridor before I thought to worry about what I was going to do when I got here. And once I thought..."
He paused, stroking my cheek.
"Well, I'm no very good, Sassnach, but I'm maybe not a coward after all."
I turned my head to meet his kiss. His stomach rumbled loudly.
"Don't laugh, you," he grumbled. "It's your fault starving me. It's a wonder I could manage at all on nothing but beef broth and eel.
All right, I said, still laughing. You win. You can have an egg for your breakfast tomorrow.
Ha, he said, in tones of deep satisfaction. I knew you'd feed me if I offered you a suitable inducement.
We fell asleep, face to face, locked in each other's arms. Chapter 41. From the Womb of the Earth. Over the next 2 weeks, Jamie continued to heal, and I continued to wonder. Some days I would feel that we must go to Rome, where the Pretender's court held sway, and do what? Other times I wanted with all my heart only to find a safe and isolated spot to live our lives in peace. It was a warm, bright day, and the icicles hanging from the gargoyles' noses dripped incessantly, leaving deep, ragged pits in the snow beneath the eaves. The door of Jamie's room had been left ajar, and the window uncovered to clear out some of the lingering vapours of smoke and illness. I poked my head cautiously around the jamb, not wishing to wake him if he was asleep, but the narrow cot was empty. He was seated by the open window, turned half away from the door so that his face was mostly hidden. He was desperately thin still, but the shoulders were broad and straight beneath the rough fabric of the novice's habit, and the grace of his strength was returning. He sat solidly without a tremor, back straight and legs curled back beneath the stool, the lines of his body firm and harmonious. He was holding his right wrist with his sound left hand, slowly turning the right hand in the sunlight. There was a small pile of cloth strips on the table. He had removed the bandages from the injured hand and was examining it closely. I stood in the doorway, not moving. From here, I could see the hand clearly as he turned it back and forth, probing gingerly. The stigma of the nail wound in the palm of the hand was quite small, and well healed, I was glad to see. No more than a small pink knot of scar tissue that would gradually fade. On the back of the hand, the situation wasn't so favourable. Eroded by infection, the wound there covered an area the size of sixpence, still patched with scabs and the rawness of a new scar. The middle finger, too, showed a jagged ridge of pink scar tissue running from just below the first joint almost to the knuckle. Released from their splints, the thumb and index finger were straight, but the little finger was badly twisted. That one had had 3 separate fractures, I remembered, and apparently I hadn't been able to set them all properly. The ring finger was set oddly, so that it protruded slightly upward when he laid the hand flat on the table, as he did now. Turning the hand palm upward, he began to manipulate the fingers gently. None would bend more than an inch or two, the ring finger not at all. As I had feared, the second joint was likely permanently frozen. He turned the hand to and fro, holding it before his face, watching the stiff, twisted fingers and the ugly scars, mercilessly vivid in the sunlight. Then he suddenly bent his head, clutching the injured hand to his chest, covering it protectively with a sound one. He made no sound, but the wide shoulders trembled briefly. "Jamie," I crossed the room swiftly and knelt beside him, putting my hand softly on his knee. "Jamie, I'm sorry," I said. "I did the best I could." He looked down at me in astonishment. The thick auburn lashes sparkled with tears in the sunlight, and he dashed them hastily away with the back of his hand. "What?" he said, gulping, clearly taken aback by my sudden appearance.
"Sorry? For what, Sassenach?"
"Your hand." I reached out and took it, lightly tracing the crooked lines of the fingers, touching the sunken scar on the back. "It will get better," I assured him anxiously. "Really it will. I know it seems stiff and useless right now, but that's only because it's been splinted so long and the bones haven't fully knitted yet. I can show you how to exercise and massage. You'll get back a good deal of the use of it, honestly." He stopped me by laying his good hand along my cheek.
"Did you mean..."
He started, then stopped, shaking his head in disbelief.
You thought?
He stopped once more and started over.
Sassenach, he said. You didn't think that I was grieving for a stiff finger and a few more scars?
He smiled a little crookedly.
I'm a vain man, maybe, but it doesn't go that deep, I hope.
But you... I began. He took both my hands in both of his and stood up, drawing me to my feet. I reached up and smoothed away the single tear that had rolled down his cheek. The tiny smear of moisture was warm on my thumb.
I was crying for joy, my Sassenach, he said softly.
He reached out slowly and took my face between his hands.
And thanking God that I have two hands, that I have two hands to hold you with, to serve you with, to love you with. Thanking God that I am a whole man still because of you.
I put my own hands up, cupping his.
But why wouldn't you be? I asked.
And then I remembered the butcherous assortment of saws and knives I had seen among Beaton's implements at Leoch.
And I knew. Knew what I had forgotten when I had been faced with the emergency. That in the days before antibiotics, the usual, the only cure for an infected extremity was amputation of the limb.
Oh, Jamie, I said.
I was weak-kneed at the thought, and sat down on the stool rather abruptly.
I never thought of it, I said, still stunned. I honestly never thought of it.
I looked up at him. Jamie, if I'd thought of it, I probably would have done it, to save your life.
It's not how... They don't do it that way, then, in your time.
I shook my head. No, there are drugs to stop infections. So I didn't even think of it, I marvelled. I looked up suddenly.
Did you?
He nodded.
I was expecting it. It's why I asked you to let me die that once. I was thinking of it in between the bouts of muzzy-headedness, and just for that one moment, I didn't think I could bear to live like that. It's what happened to Ian, you know.
No, really?
I was shocked.
He told me he'd lost it by grape shot, but I didn't think to ask about the details.
Aye, a grape shot wound in the leg went bad. The surgeons took it off to keep it from poisoning his blood.
He paused.
Ian does very well, all things considered, but...
He hesitated, pulling on the stiff ring finger.
I knew him before. He's as good as he is only because of Jenny. She keeps him whole.
He smiled sheepishly at me.
As ye did for me. I kinda think why women bother.
Well, I said softly, women like to do that. He laughed quietly and drew me close.
Aye, God knows why.
We stood entwined for a bit, not moving. My forehead rested on his chest, my arms around his back, and I could feel his heart beating, slow and strong. Finally he stirred and released me.
"I've something to show you," he said.
He turned and opened the small drawer of the table, removing a folded letter which he handed to me. It was a letter of introduction from Abbot Alexander, commending his nephew, James Fraser, to the attention of the Chevalier Saint-Georges, otherwise known as His Majesty King James of Scotland, as a most proficient linguist and translator.
"It's a place," Jamie said, watching as I folded the letter, "and we'll need a place to go soon. But what you told me on the hill at Craignadun, that was true, no?"
I took a deep breath and nodded. "It's true." He took the letter from me and tapped it thoughtfully on his knee.
"Then this,"
he waved the letter,
"is not without a bit of danger."
"It could be." He tossed the parchment into the drawer and sat staring after it for a moment. Then he looked up and the dark blue eyes held mine. He laid a hand along my cheek.
I meant it, Claire, he said quietly. My life is yours, and it's yours to decide what we shall do, where we go next. To France, to Italy, even back to Scotland. My heart has been yours since first I saw you, and you've held my soul and body between your two hands here, and kept them safe. We shall go, as you say.
There was a light knock at the door, and we sprang apart like guilty lovers. I dabbed hastily at my hair, thinking that a monastery, while an excellent convalescent home, lacked something as a romantic retreat. A lay brother came in at Jamie's bidding and dumped a large leather saddlebag on the table.
"From Macranach of Eldridge Manor," he said with a grin, "for my lady Broch Turach."
He bowed then and left, leaving a faint breath of seawater and cold air behind. I unbuckled the leather straps, curious to see what Macranach might have sent. Inside were three things, a note, unaddressed and unsigned, a small package addressed to Jamie, and the cured skin of a wolf smelling strongly of the tanner's arts. The note read, "For a virtuous woman is a pearl of great price, and her value is greater than rubies." Jamie had opened the other parcel. He held something small and glimmering in one hand and was quizzically regarding the wolf pelt.
"A bit odd, that. Sir Marcus has sent you a wolf pelt, Sassenach, and me a pearl bracelet. Perhaps he's got his labels mixed."
The bracelet was a lovely thing, a single row of large baroque pearls set between twisted gold chains.
"No," I said, admiring it. "He got it right. The bracelet goes with the necklace you gave me when we wed. He gave that to your mother, did you know?"
"No, I didn't," he answered softly, touching the pearls. "Father gave them to me for my wife, whoever she was to be."
And a quick smile tugged at his mouth.
"But he didn't tell me where they came from."
I remembered Sir Marcus's help on the night we had burst so unceremoniously into his house, and the look on his face when we had left him next day. I could see from Jamie's face that he also was remembering the baronet, who might have been his father. He reached out and took my hand, fastening the bracelet about my wrist. "But it's not for me," I protested.
"Aye, it is," he said firmly. "It isn't suitable for a man to send jewellery to a respectable married woman, so he gave it to me. But clearly it's for you."
He looked at me and grinned.
"For one thing, it won't go round my wrist, even scrawny as I am."
He turned to the bundled wolfskin and shook it out.
"Why ever did Macranach send you this, though?"
He draped the shaggy wolf hide about his shoulders, and I recoiled with a sharp cry. The head had been carefully skinned and cured as well, and equipped with a pair of yellow glass eyes, it was glaring nastily at me from Jamie's left shoulder.
"Ooh," I said, "it looks just like it did when it was alive."
Jamie, following the direction of my glance, turned his head and found himself suddenly face to face with the snarling countenance. With a startled exclamation, he jerked the skin off and flung it across the room.
"Jesus God," he said, and crossed himself.
The skin lay on the floor, glowering balefully in the candlelight.
"What do you mean, when it was alive, Sassenach? A personal friend, was it?"
Jamie asked, eyeing it narrowly. I told him then the things I had had no chance to tell him, about the wolf and the other wolves, and Hector, and the snow, and the cottage with the bear, and the argument with Sir Marcus, and the appearance of Murta, and the cattle, and the long wait on the hillside in the pink mist of the snow-swept night, waiting to see whether he was dead or alive. Thin or not, his chest was broad, and his arms warm and strong. He pressed my face into his shoulder and rocked me while I sobbed. I tried for a bit to control myself, but he only hugged me harder and said small and gentle things into the cloud of my hair, and I finally gave up and cried with the complete abandon of a child until I was worn to utter limpness and hiccuping exhaustion.
Come to think of it, "I've a wee gifty for you myself, Sassenach," he said, smoothing my hair.
I sniffed and wiped my nose on my skirt, having nothing else handy.
"I'm sorry I haven't got anything to give you," I said, watching as he stood up and began to dig through the tumbled bedclothes.
Probably looking for a handkerchief, I thought, sniffing some more.
"Aside from such minor gifts as my life, my manhood, and my right hand?" he asked dryly. "They'll do nicely, Modonia."
He straightened up with a novice's robe in one hand.
"Undress."
My mouth fell open.
"What?" "Undress, Sassenach, and put this on."
He handed me the robe, grinning.
"Or do you want me to turn my back first?"
Clutching the rough homespun around me, I followed Jamie down yet another flight of dark stairs. This was the third, and the narrowest yet. The lantern he held lit the stone blocks of walls no more than 18 inches apart. It felt rather like being swallowed up into the earth as we went further and further down the narrow black shaft.
"Are you sure you know where you're going?" I asked.
My voice echoed in the stairwell, but with a curiously muffled sound as though I was speaking underwater.
"Well, there's no much chance of taking the wrong turning now, is there?"
We had reached another landing, but true enough, the way ahead lay in only one direction, down. At the bottom of this flight of steps, though, we came to a door. There was a small landing, carved out of the solid side of a mountain from the looks of it, and a wide, low door made of oak planks and brass hinging. The planks were grey with age, but still solid, and the landing swept clean. Plainly, this part of the monastery was still in use then. The wine cellar, perhaps. There was a sconce near the door that held a torch, half burnt from previous use. Jamie paused to light it with a paper spill from the pile that lay ready nearby, then pushed open the unlocked door and ducked beneath the lintel, leaving me to follow. At first, I could see nothing at all inside but the glow of Jamie's lantern. Everything was black. The lantern bobbed along, moving away from me. I stood still, following the blob of light with my eyes. Every few feet he would stop, then continue, and a slow flame would rise up in his wake to burn in a small red glow. As my eyes slowly accustomed themselves, the flames became a row of lanterns situated on rock pillars, shining into the black like beacons. It was a cave. At first I thought it was a cave of crystals because of the odd black shimmer beyond the lanterns. But I stepped forward to the first pillar and looked beyond, and then I saw it. A clear black lake. Transparent water shimmering like glass over fine black volcanic sand, giving off red reflections in the lantern light. The air was damp and warm, humid with the steam that condensed on the cool cavern walls running down the ribbed columns of rock. A hot spring. The faint scent of sulphur bit at my nostrils. A hot mineral spring, then. I remembered Anselm's mentioning the springs that bubbled up from the ground near the abbey, renowned for their healing powers. Jamie stood behind me, looking out over the gently steaming expanse of jet and rubies.
"A hot bath," he said proudly. "Do you like it?"
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said.
"Oh, you do," he said, grinning at the success of his surprise. "Come in, then."
He dropped his own robe and stood glowing dimly in the darkness, patched with red in the glimmering reflection off the water. The arched ceiling of the cave seemed to swallow the light of the lanterns, so that the glow reached only a few feet before being engulfed. A little hesitantly, I let the novice's robe drop from my arms.
"How hot is it?" I asked.
"Hot enough," he answered. "Dinna worry, it won't burn you. But stay over an hour or so, and it might cook the flesh off your bones like soup meat."
"What an appealing idea," I said, discarding the robe.
Following his straight, slender figure, I stepped cautiously into the water. There were steps cut in the stone, leading down underwater, with a knotted rope fastened along the wall to provide handholds. The water flowed up over my hips, and the flesh of my belly shivered in delight as the heat swirled through me. At the bottom of the steps, I stood on clean black sand, the water just below the level of my shoulders, my breasts floating like glass fissure floats. My skin was flushed with the heat, and small prickles of perspiration were starting on the back of my neck under the heavy hair. It was pure bliss. The surface of the spring was smooth and waveless, but the water wasn't still. I could feel small stirrings, currents running through the body of the pool like nerve impulses. It was that, I suppose, added to the incredible soothing heat, that gave me the momentary illusion that the spring was alive, a warm, welcoming entity that reached out to soothe and embrace. Anselm had said that the springs had healing powers, and I wasn't disposed to doubt it. Jamie came up behind me, tiny wavelets marking his passage through the water. He reached around me to cup my breasts, softly smoothing the hot water over the upper slopes. "Do you like it, Mudunya?" He bent forward and planted a kiss on my shoulder. I let my feet float out from under me, resting against him. "It's wonderful. It's the first time I've been warm all the way through since August." He began to tow me, backing slowly through the water. My legs streamed out in the wake of our passage, the amazing warmth passing down my limbs like caressing hands. He stopped, swung me around, and lowered me gently onto hard wood. Half visible in the shadowy underwater light, I could see planks set into a rocky niche. He sat down on the bench beside me, stretching his arms out on the rocky ledge behind us. "Brother Ambrose brought me down here the other day to soak," he said, "to soften the scars a bit. It does feel good, doesn't it?" "More than good." The water was so buoyant that I felt I might float away if I loosed my hold on the bench. I looked upward into the black shadows of the roof. "Does anything live in this cave? Bats, I mean. Or fish?" He shook his head. "Nothing but the spirit of the spring, Sasanach. The water bubbles up from the earth through a narrow crack back there." He nodded toward the Stygian blackness at the back of the cave. "And trickles out through a dozen tiny openings in the rock. But there's no real opening to the outside, save the door into the monastery."
"Spirit of the spring?" I said, amused. "Sounds rather pagan, to be hiding under a monastery."
He stretched luxuriously, long legs wavering under the glassy surface like the stems of water plants.
"Well, whatever you wish to call it, it's been here a good deal longer than the monastery."
"Yes, I can see that." The walls of the cave were of smooth, dark volcanic rock, almost like black glass, slick with the moisture of the spring. The whole chamber looked like a gigantic bubble, half filled with that curiously alive but sterile water. I felt as though we were cradled in the womb-like centre of the earth, and that if I pressed my ear to the rock, I would hear the infinitely slow beat of a great heart nearby. We were very quiet for a long time then, half floating, half dreaming, brushing now and then against each other as we drifted in the unseen currents of the cave. When I spoke at last, my voice seemed slow and drugged.
"I've decided." "Ah, will it be Rome then?"
Jamie's voice seemed to come from a long way away.
"Yes, I don't know, once there." "It doesn't matter. We shall do what we can."
His hand reached for me, moving so slowly I thought it would never touch me. He drew me close until the sensitive tips of my breasts rubbed across his chest. The water was not only warm, but heavy, almost oily to the touch, and his hands floated down my back to cup my buttocks and lift me. The intrusion was startling. Hot and slippery as our skins were, we drifted over each other with barely a sensation of touching or pressure. But his presence within me was solid and intimate, a fixed point in a watery world, like an umbilical cord in the random driftings of the womb. I made a brief sound of surprise at the small inrush of hot water that accompanied his entrance, then settled firmly onto my fixed point of reference with a little sigh of pleasure.
"Oh, I like that one," he said appreciatively.
"Like what?" I asked.
"That sound that you made, the little squeak."
It wasn't possible to blush. My skin was already as flushed as it could get. I let my hair swing forward to cover my face, the curls relaxing as they dragged the surface of the water.
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be noisy."
He laughed, the deep sound echoing softly in the columns of the roof.
"I said I like it. And I do. It's one of the things I like the best about bedding you, Sasanach. The small noises that you make."
He pulled me closer so my forehead rested against his neck. Moisture sprang up at once between us, slick as the sulphur-laden water. He made a slight movement with his hips, and I drew in my breath in a half-stifled gasp.
"Yes, like that,"
he said softly.
"Or like that?"
"Ugh," I said. He laughed again, but kept doing it.
"That's what I thought most about," he said,
drawing his hand slowly up and down my back, cupping, curving, tracing the swell of my hips.
"In prison at night, chained in a room with a dozen other men, listening to the snoring and farting and groaning, I thought of those small, tender sounds that you make when I love you. And I could feel you there next to me in the dark, breathing soft and then faster. And the little grunt that you give when I first take you, as though you were settling yourself to your job."
My breathing was definitely coming faster. Supported by the dense mineral-saturated water, I was buoyant as an oiled feather, kept from floating away only by my grip on the curved muscles of his shoulders and the snug, firm clasp I kept of him lower down.
"Even better."
His voice was a hot murmur in my ear.
"When I come to you fierce and wanting and you whimper under me and struggle as though you wanted to get away. And I know it's only that you're struggling to come closer and I'm fighting the same fight."
His hands were exploring, gently, slowly as tickling a trout, sliding deep into the rift of my buttocks, gliding lower, groping, caressing the stretched and yearning point of our joining. I quivered, and the breath went from me in an unwilled gasp.
"When I come to you kneading, and you take me into you with a sigh and that quiet hum like a hive of bees in the sun, and you carry me with you into peace with a little mooning sound."
"Jamie," I said hoarsely, my voice echoing off the water. "Jamie, please."
"Not yet, Madonna."
His hands came hard around my waist, settling and slowing me, pressing me down until I did groan.
"Not yet. We've time. And I mean to hear you groan like that again, and to moan and sob even though you didna wish to, for you canna help it. I mean to make you sigh as though your heart would break, and scream with the wanting, and at last to cry out in my arms, and I shall know that I've served you well."
The rush began between my thighs, shooting like a dart into the depths of my belly, loosening my joints so that my hands slipped limp and helpless off his shoulders. My back arched, and the slippery, firm roundness of my breasts pressed flat against his chest. I shuddered in hot darkness, Jamie's steadying hands all that kept me from drowning. Resting against him, I felt boneless as a jellyfish. I didn't know or care what sort of sounds I had been making, but I felt incapable of coherent speech. Until he began to move again, strong as a shark under the dark water.
"No," I said. "Jamie, no. I can't bear it like that again."
The blood was still pounding in my fingertips, and his movement within me was an exquisite torture.
"You can, for I love you."
His voice was half muffled in my soaking hair.
And you will, for I want you. But this time, I go with you.
He held my hips firm against him, carrying me beyond myself with the force of an undertow. I crashed formless against him like breakers on a rock, and he met me with the brutal force of granite, my anchor in the pounding chaos. Boneless and liquid as the water around us, contained only by the frame of his hands, I cried out, the soft, bubbling, half-choked cry of a sailor sucked beneath the waves. And heard his own cry, helpless in return, and knew I had served him well. We struggled upward, out of the womb of the world, damp and steaming, rubber-limbed with wine and heat. I fell to my knees at the first landing, and Jamie, trying to help me, fell down next to me in an untidy heap of robes and bare legs. Giggling helplessly, drunk more with love than with wine, we made our way side by side, on hands and knees, up the second flight of stairs, hindering each other more than helping, jostling and caroming softly off each other in the narrow space, until we collapsed at last in each other's arms on the second landing. Here, an ancient oriel window opened glassless to the sky, and the light of the hunter's moon washed us in silver. We lay clasped together, damp skins cooling in the winter air, waiting for our racing hearts to slow and breath to return to our heaving bodies. The moon above was a Christmas moon, so large as almost to fill the empty window. It seemed no wonder that the tides of sea and woman should be subject to the pull of that stately orb, so close and so commanding. But my own tides move no longer to that chaste and sterile summons, and the knowledge of my freedom raced like danger through my blood. "I have a gift for you too," I said suddenly to Jamie. He turned toward me, and his hand slid, large and sure, over the plane of my still flat stomach.
"Have you now?" he said.
And the world was all around us, new with possibility.
The End. You've been listening to Outlander by Diana Gabaldon, narrated by Davina Porter. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Wedding by Julie Garwood, narrated by Stephen Crossley. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, in the Recorded Books catalogue. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800-638-1304. You can order by phone with